You're listening to Dig Deep on Northern Community Radio. I'm Heidi Holton. Joining me now are Chuck Marone and Aaron Brown. They are with us to continue this conversation today about the environment and climate change. Now, where do we begin here, Chuck? You really wanted to dig deep into this idea.
Yeah, right? I think climate change is one of these areas where you have an acute problem that kind of defies our regulatory process. We can go through a permitting process for a new power plant, and we can go through and require them to have the best available technology. And, you know, here's our standard that we've set up, and you have to meet this. And you know, if you don't, you won't get your permit. And they come in and meet it. And then, you know, you look and it's still pumping out carbon in the air. It still is, in a sense, like adding to the amount of carbon in the environment. And is that a win? Is that have we done anything? Have we made anything better? You look at California, one of the most environmentally rah-rah, like we're going to be pro-environment states. And yeah, they're, you know, having people talk about solar panels. They're having people talk about wind energy, but they're building power plants all over the place. Their people are driving everywhere. You can switch out an electric vehicle, an EV vehicle, for a gas vehicle. You're still burning a ton of gas. You're still emitting a ton of gas. How do you deal with that? And I think our conversation from a regulatory standpoint has not evolved to actually address those issues. Those issues are not permitting issues. The estrogen in the water that I talked about last time is not really a permitting issue. You're going to not permit the medication? You're going to not, you know, permit someone to take something that will help them and assist them? No, you're not. So you're not going to have that. So what do you do at that point? And I think, you know, we have not figured that out. We've not resolved that. And of course, our politics on it is in flames.
Well, it's screwy. I mean, it's impossible to move anything in terms of policy. We've had little moments, you know, solar subsidies or something can actually reach the president's desk at this time or another. But as we learn, times change, politics change, and those regulations get chucked. And we're left right where we were before, you know, and nothing really has changed. I would compare it a little bit to the idea of, you know, steering one of those big Lake Superior ore ships, how hard it is for them to move, or stopping a train, why it takes so long for a train at full speed to pull itself to a stop. It takes a tremendous amount of energy just to make a minute change in outcome. So that just makes this whole policy discussion very difficult. And like Chuck was saying, a lot of this is not related to a specific permitting issue. The Emerald Ash Borer being a good example. KAXC is nothing if not your Emerald Ash Borer headquarters.
Spokesperson. Yeah.
if you want to know about this issue.
EAB, right? That's what you're talking about.
That's right. And if you peruse the archives, you can find ample coverage of this issue. It's a small bug, I'll call it, that gets deposited in ash trees, and it destroys the ash tree. And even when you wait through a winter, they're back, you know, and if you burn a log with larvae in it or whatever, it creates all these problems. Well, you get down to it. And the real problem is our winters are not, they're plenty cold, don't get me wrong, but they're not killing off a lot of insects, harmful insects, through the long winters the way they used to. So without the number of days below zero, I think John Latimer had this as a Daily Phenology a few weeks ago. I remember it talking about how certain insects are now surviving the winter that never were surviving the winter before, which means they're able to go further and further north in the summers, and they're causing all the more damage in the process. What kind of permit is going to change that? What kind of environmental policy? We can't make it colder. We can try to mitigate through not transporting firewood or things like that, but these are small problems. And if you talk to these folks who study this issue, they say, when is the emerald ash borer going to get here? Eventually.
Well, let me give you another example.
Yeah.
Every lake will eventually have milfoil.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, it's statistically, in a sense, inevitable, just because it doesn't take that much to happen, and you can't be as rigorous. I know people don't want to hear that. Like, they're like, no, we have to stop this. And I agree. Like, I'm not advocating go put milfoil on every lake. But I'm saying the idea that somehow this will be arrested by having kindly people sitting at the at the landing talking to you about milfoil in your boat, I don't know if that's an effective policy response. When you get into something like climate change now, And I was just thinking as we're talking here, I would like to at some point do an episode on science and just the religious science back and forth and the idea that science as a religion, because I do have some nuance with science on climate change that I think is very important. But for the sake of this conversation, let's just posit that it, you know, the whole narrative is as we all understand it. How do you deal with that? There's a number of responses, all of which are actually inadequate to the problem as it's been defined. Even the most aggressive, you know, Paris Accord, what have you, would have us get back to levels that are only going to destroy us in 50 years instead of 40 years. It's not really a policy response up to the level of the problem. This gets into, you know, okay, what do you do then? And I think, you know, I can go back to Chernobyl. I can go back to the estrogen example. Really, what you're left with is adaptation. And that's very unpalatable for me. I think it's very unpalatable for a lot of people that we have to get used to living in a warmer world. We have to get used to living in a place that's going to have milfoil and emerald ash borer. There are people who are suggesting that we should go up and tinker with the climate by releasing particulates into the air to block the sun. That sounds crazy to me, right? But is that actually what we're getting to as a way to address some of these issues? I don't know. I just know that, like, the Clean Air Act is not dealing with this. The Clean Air Act is not, like, the thing that's going to save this. The Clean Water Act is not going to fix your lake, because there's nobody actually responsible in the Clean Water Act for the water clarity in your lake. There's no agency, there's no permit process, there's nothing. And the things that are destroying it are 1,000 little cuts from all over the place.
So how do politics hinder the conversations that you think we should be having?
Well, I think the debate is, I mean, the debate isn't talking about this. The debate isn't talking about either slowing down or stopping climate change. It's not talking about adapting to climate change. It's talking about whether or not climate change is quote unquote real. And that just shows, I think, a lot of, that's more of a cultural question because it has nothing to do with science. You know, no one, you know, there's some limited scientific findings that run against what the preponderance of science shows. And if you want to glom onto those, that's something you can do. But for the most part, there is some consensus showing, and indeed, if you talk to people who live in a place for 30 years, they know that it's different 30 years ago than it is now. Certainly, I know a lot of conservative people here in northern Minnesota who have observed these changes. Loggers will tell you that there are differences in the trees and differences in the forest related to climate. It's this fact that we have to have a debate where, you know, climate change is real and we need to do something. No, it's not real. We should double down on coal. It becomes the debate. Well, that's a useless debate. Because first of all, there's a number of other economic reasons why things are changing, cost-related reasons, resource-related reasons. And so it's a false fight. So we aren't able to truly discuss what do we do when cities like Las Vegas, which are growing metropolises, maybe not as fast as they were growing 10 years ago, but these metropolises who dwell in deserts and we have to get them water. Are we going to ship them Lake Superior? Because that's, you know,
that's a proposal on the table.
That's out there. It's a preponderous idea.
You're looking confused.
A proposal on the table.
Absolutely. There's a Corps of Engineers study of running a big, huge pipe from Lake Superior down to
the Southwest.
Yeah.
Yeah. And of course,
it's good
right now
they're not putting tailings in there anymore. Then, right?
Well, maybe we will.
That's the solution. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Put the tailings in. Oh yeah. Oh boy, that was nitty. All right. So. But really, of course, that's against law right now, you know, and right now the Great Lakes states are united as a front in preventing this. But, you know, the Great Lakes are connected, you might notice, and all it takes is a little Indiana up by Erie to decide we're going to stick a pipe in there and we're going to go after this stuff, and it would change. So we have to watch this because it could have long-term effects, not just for the Southwest. Why are we propping up cities in places where cities shouldn't be? You know, in the old days, people would abandon areas that were no longer habitable, so they would move. But then again, there's so much real estate value and money in these cities that they couldn't possibly move. It's a little like here on the range where the iron ore is underneath the town, and you have to do an equation to figure out whether or not you move the town to get at the ore. And right now, the ore under the range towns is not worth moving a town. Will it one day? This is the question we have to ask about the cities across America with our resources like fresh water, which is probably one of the most threatened things in climate change. access to water, drinking water, water you can use. And we've got it here. And even as it gets warmer, we know, I always like to say, northern Minnesota is a future paradise, because we will see things we love go away, like the moose, which we're watching happen, and we'll see our trees change and the old pine forests will go away. And we don't want these things to happen, but as they happen, we'll still be able to live here. But that's not the case everywhere.
Let me say this specifically about climate change. I want to give you plenty of time to respond to this. I'm going to go after the left side of the political spectrum a little bit. That's a trigger warning. So what we hear continually from the left politically is that climate change is the existential problem of our time. Here's what I would posit as a response then. If it is the existential problem of our time, and I can be sympathetic to the science and that argument, does that not mean that we need a society-wide solution? In other words, does that not mean that you got to drop your, let's say Aaron and I are on a boat together, and the existential crisis is that we both have to bail with buckets for this, or this boat's going to go down, but we hate each other. And so Aaron sits and like lobs insults at me, and I sit and lob insults at him. And I'm like, the boat's not going down. You're like, yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. Well, I think if Aaron is a smart guy, he's like, okay, I'm going to work with you now. Like, we just got to get working on the same page. To me, we will not solve climate change until we actually engage conservative values on it. When we start with essentially, I think, regulation, and when we start with more bureaucracy, and when we start with some of the premise that we start our debate with right now, it just goes nowhere. And I think if you're sitting at home thinking climate change is the most urgent thing in the world, then you need to talk to a conservative in their language. Here's what I would do to deal with climate change. I think we have to look and say, the thing we need more than anything else is a price on carbon. You actually need to pay for the environmental damage you do as you consume energy, as you consume gasoline, as you create carbon emitted in the atmosphere. You're never going to get that unless you turn around and say, we'll eliminate employer taxes to offset that. We'll eliminate maybe the income tax. In other words, one of the biggest fears that conservative legislators tend to have is this idea that we're just adding more bureaucracy. We're just adding more process. We're just adding more government. We're just creating another tax. And not only another tax, but another centralized system that's just going to benefit insiders. I think you can sell this to the regular population, the people in this country who lean conservative, by saying, look, we're going to tax the things we don't want, and we're going to not tax the things we do want. We do want income. We do want employment. We do want jobs. We don't want pollution. We don't want waste. Let's change our tax code to actually tax the things we don't want. I think if we had that type of an approach from the left, we could find allies on the right and actually create a consensus agenda to do something to tackle some of these urgent problems. To me, we're lost in this morass of politics today that in a short-term gain, both sides benefit from, because both sides can ramp up their partisan language and get their people all riled up. I actually think, by the way, if we did that, we'd actually have a rational conversation about climate change, because I think the hysterics on that from the left just dwarf everything and keep us from having a good conversation.
Okay, let me start with what I like about that. All right. First of all, I agree that you don't change. I teach persuasion. You don't change someone's mind by attacking them. You don't. If you call a person a terrible person, if you call them evil, you are unlikely to persuade them. If the only reason to ever do that is to persuade others who might also think that they're evil, but if you need their vote, that's not going to work. And we've learned about where the vote split is in this country, and it's about 50-50. So in other words, nothing's going to get done calling the other side evil or calling them impossible to work with or this kind of thing. One of the concerns I would have there is I don't know that fixing this or addressing conservation in a broad sense is going to be revenue neutral. you talk about taking away taxes to pay for the carbon tax. Now, you know, I hear things like that. By the way, I kind of like the carbon tax as one way to do this. I generally like the concept of tax reform that, again, taxes, like you said, tax things you don't want while loosening up on things that you do want. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
So that idea, and I've heard it from other conservatives, not just my friend Chuck, but people in Congress believe this. People in the Senate believe this. Not most of them on the Republican side. It's kind of a mix. Just like on the Democratic side, you can find some people that are open to discussing. I think President Obama, being a classic example, came in and he wanted, in his head, he wanted to be this great negotiator, this bipartisan guy who could reach out and he would go talk to the Republicans. And frankly, he had the door slammed in his face. And then the sides. Chuck has conservative friends who would not be open to that. I have liberal friends who would not be open to any discussion about trading tax revenue for a carbon tax. And the sides ramp up their war machines, and it becomes difficult. And this isn't just the environment. This is entitlement reform. This is a lot of issues, not just the environment. In this political structure we've got, it's really difficult to address the big problems. We can argue about little problems, but we can't solve the big ones. So that's a challenge that I think goes into our political system as much as it is an environmental question. Because you talk about the conservative case, or even the religious conservative case for addressing climate change. It's there. It's the notion of preserving a world for our children. You know, that's something that's built into Christian values. That's something that's built into conservative values. You know, it might manifest a little differently than a liberal would look at it, but basically, we're all on the same page here. That's what we want. But getting people to that centrist kind of mindset, or at least that central negotiating point where there's an exchange, a trade, and no one's willing to trade away anything. It's like two big sports franchises that have a lot of players, and they would be well served to trade some of them for their needs, but nobody wants to give up value. We don't want to give up a valuable. Democrats know that Republicans never vote for taxes, so if you trade away a tax, you're never going to get it back. Republicans know if you trade away for spending or if you trade away for a program, you might never get that back in the political environment we're in, so they no one wants to trade. And as a result, we sit there with our inadequate solutions and fail to find consensus. I think it'll just take conditions will, I think, dictate some of this.
There's a book called Strangers in Their Own Land. I've referred to it in the past on the show by Arlie Hochschild. She was a Berkeley professor who went to Louisiana and lived in Tea Party country just to, what she called it, create an empathy bridge to try to understand, you know, why would these people believe the things that they believed. And it's a very insightful book because she found that once she tried to empathize and understand, a lot of it made a lot more sense to her. They weren't crazy. They weren't baseless. And particularly on the environment, because there's a lot of environmental destruction in Louisiana from oil refineries and other things. And when she would talk to people about this and ask them, don't you want an active state? Don't you want people to step in and deal with this? Don't you want some regulation so that the lake you enjoy actually has fish again and that? And they would say, you know, those rules don't work for us. Those rules are designed to work for the corporation. It's not that they were pro-refinery or pro-pollution, but they said, you know, if I'm out here and a little gas leaks out of my gas can on the back of my boat, the game warden's going to come and give me a fine. That corporation over there can leak pollution in this lake for decades and kill everything. Nothing happens to them at all. I can go out and accidentally, you know, I can go out and even intentionally shoot a rare bird, and I'm going to get thrown in prison and for violating environmental law. They can poison every bird and kill every single one of them, and nothing happens to them. And so there's an aversion to the way we have structured this today, the bureaucracy, the regulation, the approach. And I agree with that. I think it is antiquated. I think it is based on dealing with a 1950s and 60s problem. And I think our problems now are not acute point source problems. They're chronic spread out problems. And that requires a much different approach. One that is far less regulatory, far less process, far fewer attorneys and engineers and people sitting around in public hearings for 7 years, and far more kind of modern, tactical, and I think focus on people's pocketbooks as true incentives.
Chuck Marone. He's our conservative commentator. Aaron Brown is our liberal commentator. This is our conversation on Dig Deep, and you can catch it either on the air, or if you haven't yet, sign up for the podcast. Find it at our website, kexe.org, and there will be an extra podcast-only conversation coming up. Continuing environment, but digging deep into District 8 and what's happening there.
Politics.